Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this, what is today? Wednesday. I remembered last hour. I forgot this hour. It's Wednesday, the 4th of April, and we're happy to have Janine Geske with us this hour. We have much to discuss with her. The last time I saw her, she had just returned, and this was a few weeks ago, from New Orleans, where she had brought a number of Marquette University law students to do pro bono law work in New Orleans, and she had some very interesting things to say about what's happening or what is not happening in that city. Today she's all over the press because she's responding to the Supreme Court race that where so much money was spent, and she has concerns about that. But her big passion is restorative justice, and we'll be talking a great deal about that this hour. She is the director of the Restorative Justice Initiative at Marquette University, where she is a distinguished professor of law and an adjunct associate professor in the Marquette Center for Dispute Resolution Program. She's had a distinguished career as a judge. She served on the Wisconsin Supreme Court from 93 to 98. She was a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge from 81 to 83, interim Milwaukee County executive and interim dean of the Marquette Law School. Before becoming a judge, she served as chief staff attorney for the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee. And I would suspect that some of that work informed the work that she has done subsequent to that. She's also founder of the Marquette University Law School Clinic for the Elderly. She has won many awards for her work in justice, and we're so happy to have her with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Janine, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello. It's my pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here. There's a lot to talk about. Let's start, though, because I was struck by what you said about New Orleans. You brought some Marquette students down there just a few weeks ago to do pro bono work. What did you see?
Well, first I want to correct you. The law students brought me. they initiated it and organized it, and I was privileged to be able to go with them. It was really shocking to me. And, you know, I've seen all the news where they've talked about, you know, all the homes that are still in shambles. But to see the whole system falling apart in the community, we spent time particularly in the justice system. Everything from some of my students interviewing prisoners who were described, and many of them described the same story of being left in jails during Katrina, not told what was happening, and the water rising now, literally treading water, and for 4 days being without food or electricity until they were finally rescued by boats. And then going into the criminal courts and seeing what chaos there is. Many of the prosecutors and many of the public defenders never came back after the both the flooding, the Katrina, and then the flooding. The prisoners were shipped all over the state into sometimes maximum security prisons. People didn't know where they were. They were not represented because their lawyers had left. And now some of those cases are, they're attempting to bring those to trial. You got lawyers that don't know anything about the case. You've got offenders who've been in prison for our jail for a long time. The evidence rooms were all flooded, so the evidence
got all wet.
And judges are being faced with motions for speedy trial and asked that release. I saw in the news yesterday that a judge was going to have to release another number of alleged murders. That is just one piece of it. There, the housing issue is huge. There's not a mental health bed, we were told, in the entire city, and obviously at a time when there's a great deal need for mental health treatment. The mental health professionals left in droves and did not return. I think there's like 4 out of the 11 or 13 hospitals that are actually open. So the infrastructure is just a disaster. And in talking to people who are working very hard down there, they are becoming very pessimistic about the ability to be able to return and improve from what they had before. They had many problems before, both in the police department and in the system, but now it's much worse.
Is it a lost city, do you think? Is there hope there?
You know, it's hard to tell, and I know better than to go in for a week and come to that conclusion.
Right.
But, you know, when I see people that have worked in difficult neighborhoods all over the country for years and years and years and really, really been optimistic in their work, tell me that they are afraid to go out on the streets because of the high level of danger. And, you know, that places, I mean, people cannot return to their homes. In addition to gutting the homes, there's still 2,000 houses that have to be gutted. They then have to take the mold out with bleach. And then they have to raise the house three feet in order to get flood insurance. I don't know how people are coping. It's 18 months later. One of the things that was reported in the news at the time is that there's this program, I think it's called Home Again, and it's federal money going through the state. And at least we were told there were 130,000 applications for those monies and that only 800 had been processed to date. Mm. So, you know, it's just, it really, it is concerning. We talked to a Jesuit provincial down there who was head of Catholic Charities nationally, went to law school actually with Bill Clinton, very accomplished lawyer and Jesuit priest, and loves New Orleans. And he said, I used to say 5 to 10 years. He said, if it's going to come back, it's going to be 20 years. So,
oh, gee.
Yeah.
Breaks your heart, really, doesn't it?
It did.
Restorative justice, you've described it as your passion. I read, tell me if this is a good description here, a new model of response to criminal acts similar to the Christian view of justice, mercy, and forgiveness philosophy that supports victims and communities as they deal with the aftermath of crime.
That's not a bad definition, but it's not limited to Christian. You know, I have given speeches to Jewish groups with rabbis who talked about, you know, the traditions in the Jewish religion that are very consistent and consonant with restorative justice. It's based on a lot of tribal traditions, indigenous people. So it's not a bad description, but I wouldn't limit it to Christian.
Mm-hmm. And what I think of, because I've heard you talk about this, is I think of the person who committed a horrendous act meeting with the family members, be it robbery or a murder or whatever, that they need to see the impact of the action on other people's lives. Do you bring these people together?
We do, but let me step back for a minute to talk a little bit. The difference, and it doesn't mean that our criminal justice system gets thrown out, but the difference between our traditional criminal justice system, where we look at whether an offender has done certain acts and whether the state can prove that person guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and then what we do with that person if they're found guilty, the difference is instead of focusing on the offender, we focus on the harm. The harm to the community and the neighborhood and the victim, and then say, where do we go from here on the harm? And part of it is holding the offender accountable for what he or she did, but also to have the offender understand the harm they did and to see ways that the community can help the victim, they can help restore the harm, and hopefully, you know, work with the offender if he or she's taken responsibility to help repair the harm, whether it's behind bars or not. There are different processes. Some are what we call circles, Native American circles. We're doing a lot of that with violence in our community right now, and if you want me to talk about it, I will.
Please, yeah.
But we also do where family members of homicide victims and victims of crimes want to meet face-to-face with an offender, and amazingly, a lot of people do. We facilitate those, and those are long processes. They take 6 months to 12 months to do. But those are all victim-focused. They're when victims want to do it, when survivors want to have that meeting, not when offenders want it. And so we focus on communities and victims, not on offenders, but offenders are obviously an integral part of this triangle.
Why would so many survivors want to meet with the offender?
Well, let me talk about, you know, there's obviously different levels, but I'm going to talk about the crimes of severe violence because that's the one people can't believe that anyone would ever want to do it. And let me talk about homicide, family members of homicide victims. My experience with family members, and we've got about 8 of these going on right now, the family members wanted a couple of things. They often want the offender to understand who it is they took and what they took from their family and their friends and their loved ones, because that is never really expressed in a courtroom, in a criminal court. You know, the fact that Christmas comes in and there's an empty place at the table, family members fall apart in their relationships because of it. So to somehow give a face and a voice and a life to the person who died. But another big part of it is, in a homicide case, what happened? What were those last minutes like? Mm. Did the victim struggle? Mm. What did he or she say? Mm. You know, what did the offender say? What were the circumstances? Because often it's only the murderer who has the answers to those questions. And we only do these where offenders are admitting they did it. And we obviously don't do it where an offender says, you got the wrong person. But, and then often, because these are often done 5, 10, 15, 20, sometimes 30 years after the crime, it is, what have you been doing with your life, Mr. or Ms. Offender? You know, what do you do on the anniversary of the murder? Do you remember the person you killed? Hmm. And what are you doing in the prison? And for some family members, they want to express some forgiveness. And that is completely driven by victims, whether they want to do that or not. And I always say forgiveness has different definitions to different people. For some people, it's sort of a religious connotation and saying, it's okay, I don't want you to be in prison anymore. That's a real rare case. More likely, it's, I'm not going to be held captive to my rage towards you anymore. I'm laying down my anger, and I hope you go on and live your life and that some good comes out of this. Mm-hmm. I don't think you should get out of prison, but, you know, I want you to know that I don't walk around angry with you anymore. And for other people, a forgiveness is really a private event that has nothing to do with the offender. They never want to express it, and it really is your own personal journey of forgiveness.
Tell the story. I don't know how old this is, but I'm sure you'll remember it, of the sisters whose father was killed and there are so many twists and turns in this story, but it finally ended with their being able to sleep with the lights off.
Right. And I have now permission to talk about this completely, but there were two sisters, adult sisters, whose father was killed in an armed robbery in Racine. He was a delivery man for a restaurant, and the offender had called up a false order and then waited in the bushes and put the gun to his head when he got there. And the offender always claimed that the gun went off, and I put this in quotes, accidentally, because it was a loaded gun to his head during an armed robbery. The offender eventually pled guilty to, I think, a second-degree murder, an armed robbery, and a number of other offenses, and got a very long sentence. 6 years passed, and the sisters had gone through a tough journey, including sleeping with the lights on, both of them in their respective homes, afraid, wondering if he was part of a gang and they were to come back and get them. The father of the victim died. It was so grief-stricken, died on the one-year anniversary of the murder. I mean, all their story, like so many stories, are just the horrible ripple effect of that kind of crime to a family. And so 6 years later, they decided they were ready to hear the offender's version, and they wanted to know a couple things about what happened. They wanted to know if their father had struggled, what their father had said, and how their father had fallen, face down or face up on the sidewalk. Now, that seems odd.
Yes.
But I can tell you that family members replay that crime in their head about 50,000 different ways over and over, and they finally want to know which was it, what was it.
Right.
Often I ask family members, what if it's a terrible answer? And they'll say, you know what, the offender cannot hurt me anymore, they've hurt me. I want to know what it was. So we worked on this for almost a year. The offender took responsibility and wanted to meet with them and to give back to them whatever he could. So we had a meeting. It was the two sisters and the offender and me. Now I always have students involved, but there was just the four of us, and it lasted about 4 hours.
Oh my gosh, Jane.
And we almost always have a picture of the victim there so the offender can see what the victim looked like. There was a long description of the terrible implications, which are much longer than I have time to explain right now, the offender hearing what exactly his actions had caused into their family. When talking about the crime, and he like so many of these offenders, say, I know saying I'm sorry seems so shallow, but that's all I can give you, you know, and I want you to know that I think about every night the fact that I murdered your father and took that from you. But when answering the questions about the crime, he reported that the victim did not struggle. He didn't say anything, and the gun went off almost immediately after he'd ordered him to put the food down. When asked about face up, face down on the sidewalk, the offender said, I ran, I don't know, I didn't see him. They went on to talk about what the offender was doing now in prison, and the victims had a lot of interest in that. And at the end of their meeting, in this particular case, one of the sisters said, I want you to know I forgive you, and actually gave him a hug.
Oh, my gosh.
The other sister said to him at the end, I want you to know I've not been able to put my father's picture on the wall for 6 years since the murder. Tonight it's going back up. And so on the way back, I drove them back to Racine, and they reported to me that they were so enthralled with the meeting. They still do. I talk to them periodically. They weren't going to get the answer to the one question, but they got all the rest of the answers, and they felt very, very good about the meeting and the way the offender had reacted. I returned to my classroom that night and taught a class. It was the second class of the semester, and I was able to tell part of the story, but I was not to reveal their identity because one of their relatives didn't know they were doing this. And so I told my students sort of vaguely about what had happened and then taught my class. At the end of the class, a male student came up and said, that happened in Racine, didn't it? And of course, my heart sunk, you know, my duty of confidentiality. And so it's all about me. So I'm apologizing and telling him not to tell anybody. And then he said, and I have permission to do all this now. Yeah. He said, it's Mr. Miller, and it was the right victim. And I just thought, oh my God, what did I do? So I apologized again and told him not to tell anybody. And he's walking out, and I stopped him and I said, why do you know this? And I had told a story about the gravestone that I won't take the time to tell now, and he said, I recognize that story. And I'm thinking, again, about me. Why did I tell that part of the story? I didn't have to tell it. And then I realized, I don't know yet. And I run down the hall, and I catch him, and I said, why do you know this? And this still gives me chills. He said, I was the first police officer on the scene that night. I looked at him, and I said, what? And he said, I used to be a city of Racine police officer, and I heard the shot and was there. And I said, so you were the first one in Mr. Miller? And he said, yes. And I said, you wouldn't remember if he's face up or face down.
Oh, Jeanine, it gives me chills now, too.
And he said, yeah, he was face up. I called those sisters an hour and a half after I dropped them off and said, I have the answer to your last question. And for them, it was very much a religious experience. It isn't that way for all survivors, but they, for them, that was a sign from God and really was an answer to their last prayer, and they were so grateful. They wrote me a later letter, and they said, you know what? If we can forgive the man who murdered our father, we ought to be able to forgive those people who do a lot less to us.
Mm.
I learned so much. It's such a privilege to be with victims as they walk that journey, and I see it time and time and time and time again. I'm meeting with another family where the daughter was killed, and when talking to the father, and one of the questions I say was, why do you want to do this? And I've not met with the offender in this case yet, and he said, this is not going to seem to make sense, but I want to make his life better because I want to give meaning to the death of my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And if it makes him a better person and he lives his life a better way, then there is some good comes out of her death. You know, I am so in awe of people's courage to be able to do that, and it's such a privilege. But, it really is an amazing thing, and it is so counterintuitive in our culture that we would sit down in those kinds of conversations, and yet such great blessings come out of them that it really is an amazing, and it's fun to be able to bring law students into this and teach them how to be more compassionate lawyers and to be leaders in our community to do this kind of work.
Yeah. Do most offenders want to be a part of this, and if so, for what reason, Jeanine, or is there a reluctance?
It's interesting because, offenders generally are, first of all, shocked that the victim's family wants to meet with them.
Huh.
And, and we always talk about that it's going to be we call it a tough conversation in a safe environment. We make it a safe environment. We don't take victims in who want to come across the table and strangle the guy. They can be real angry, and that's totally appropriate, and I warn the offenders about that. The power shift is incredible because the offender was in the position of power at the time of the crime, but now the victim's in the position of power. When she or he walks into a maximum security prison, the offender's there, but most offenders that we meet, that we talk to, it's the great majority say, you know what, I took a life. If I can give something back, I want to do that. Mm-hmm. And I tell them, look, you cannot do this for parole purposes. None of us are going to appear on your behalf. This may not help you. And in fact, it may backfire. The victim may walk out and think you are more dangerous than when they walked in. And I've had that happen.
Mm.
And so don't do this. For anything that you may gain out of it. But I'll tell you that offenders have told me, and these are people that are probably never going to get out of prison, that in some cases it's been the best thing they ever did in their lives. It was the most rewarding to be able to have that conversation.
Hmm. I remember I was just dumbfounded doing an interview with one of the fathers, and you probably know this person because I think he was speaking at Marquette, whose daughter was killed in the Oklahoma City bombings.
Right.
And he was talking, he was divorced, he was traveling with his divorced wife, so they were having reconciliation, and he went to Timothy McVeigh's parents because he didn't believe in the death penalty and because he wanted to reach out to them because they were in such pain. And I thought, oh my God, what a heart you've got. I mean, how many people could do something like that?
Well, and another example is the Amish recently with the shooting in the school.
Yes.
We all admire that, and I'll put myself, I have no idea where I'd be. I'd like to think, but I could somehow walk in those shoes. It's hard for me to imagine that I could with the rage. So the other part of what we do is the circle work, and that's really based on Native American traditions. That is, you bring community together, offenders, and it may be the direct victim or other victims of crime, and what the natives do is because we're all interconnected. It's not a judge behind a podium or on a bench. It's we're all together in a circle. They use a talking piece or a talking stick, and it has great spiritual value. The Native Americans often use a eagle feather or something very symbolic. When we do it, I use a rock and some other spiritual significant item. And what happens is you have a conversation by passing the talking piece around the room, and each person holds it. And when you hold it, you can talk from your heart. You know you'll be respected. No one's going to question you. No one's going to argue. And the person across the room who may want to interrupt or say something can't. Mm. And so it really forces people to listen in a way that we're not used to in our culture. And I have to tell you, we've been doing, we started actually doing a large circle right after Memorial Day shootings last year when going to whistle bad. And actually, the mayor participated. We had a number of elected officials. We had some juvenile offenders. We had neighbors. And we had a large circle where people just had a chance to pass a talking piece and talk about what violence, how it had impacted them. Mm-hmm. And I just want to share one story. We did one on the north side at Heartlove a couple of months ago. India McCann's from Big Brothers and Big Sisters and I and my students have been working on these. And we had a couple of police officers in the circle along with people from the neighborhood. And I'm just going to tell the story of one officer because it was so moving. When the piece got to him, and I had to give, you know, you have to give some police officers, take some courage to sit in this environment and talk. And he described a number of years ago when he was responding to a shooting, and when he got to the shooting, he realized, first, he was the first officer on the scene, and secondly, it was the shooting of a two-year-old, a little girl, with a bullet to her head. Mm. And he described what it was like to run up the steps to that house and hearing the screaming, you know, and the noise and the sirens coming, and getting into that house and coming upon that two-year-old little girl with a bullet hole who still was gasping, and him picking up that child and holding that child in his arms. And he said it was like he knew all that noise and chaos was going on, and yet he was just present to this child who was dying, and she died in his arms. Mm. And he said how he's talked to doctors about, could he have done something? Could there, you know, and of course the answer is no. And he told the circle that every time he responds to a shooting in the city, he carries that child with him now. Well, you know, to have that kind of story told in that environment changes. And I said to the group, and I've said publicly, people sitting in that room will never be able to say every police officer doesn't care. Mm-hmm. You know, you may you can have all your opinions generically, but you won't. And each time you do that, to see that kind of human compassion. And I went up to him and I thanked him for sharing that pretty intimate story. And he said, you know, I've never publicly talked about it. But it was the circle. And to have moms talk about what it's like having to go to the funerals of their sons, or, you know, seeing boys shot in front of them on the streets and what the impact of that is. We did one at the Black Historical Museum last week. And as we were doing it, someone came in because the shooting had happened down the street. Mr. Huggins had been shot on Sherman and Capitol. We were at 27th, I think, in Center. And you know, right in the middle of us doing the circle, we had to again talk about what that meant to the community. So it's a chance for people to come together in a very different forum, in a different, and so it is healing. I mean, it's healing because it's a recognition of the harm. And then the next step is saying, how do we come together as community?
Jeanine Geske is our guest. We're talking about restorative justice and welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Jeanine is director of the Restorative Justice Initiative at Marquette. She's a distinguished professor of law in the law school there, and she served on the Wisconsin Supreme Court for a number of years, and, well, the resume goes on. Phone calls from you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, we'll be talking with the author of Lincoln's Sword, The Presidency and the Power of Words. Douglas Wilson is the author. He's co-director of the Lincoln Studies Center at Knox College. That's coming up tomorrow. And global warming, the first hour of the program. Phone calls now for Jeanine, and let's go to Day Key from Milwaukee first. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I love hearing this. I'm a state coordinator for the Peace Alliance campaign, which is looking to establish a Department of Peace and Nonviolence at the national level. And the people that I work with and coordinate, as well as myself, would be very interested in promoting and participating in this program. So I wonder, Jeanine, is there some component for the citizen to be involved as well?
Yes, there is. And frankly, I didn't have a chance to talk about, but we just were awarded a contract under a U.S. Department of Justice big grant to Milwaukee to deal with anti-gang prevention and intervention. And we're going to be working with the community in both police districts 2 and 5 doing this kind of work. Our goal really is to train people from the community to participate, to be facilitators of circles, to participate in circles. This is not for us to come in and tell people how to do it. It's to train people. So if you want to contact us at the Restorative Justice Initiative, and I should have brought phone numbers, and I don't want to give the wrong phone number. I think it's, but my, if
Let
you
me
want
see
to
if
just
I
email.
Have it,
okay. Yolanda Terrell-Zeider is our administrative assistant, and I think it's 288-7924. If you let me give you the general number at Marquette Law School, and that will make sure you get the right place.
Good. Okay.
288-7090 is the main office, and it's just asked for restorative justice, and they'll connect you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dakey, for the call. Lisa is next from Toma. Hi, Lisa.
Yes. I wish there had been some kind of program like this available. My brother murdered a man, and it was so devastating after the fact. You know, the community rallies around the victim, but with the family, I don't look at things, and I mean, I was horrified at what he had done, but by the same token, you know, he committed suicide himself afterwards, and we were just devastated as well. You know, it took almost 20 years for us to get over it, but I will say that the police in that, we were never even notified. We found out he was dead, on the 5 o'clock news.
Oh my gosh! Where was this? Was this in Wisconsin?
In Las Vegas, Nevada.
Las Vegas. Mm.
You know, and I didn't have a chance to mention this. When I talk about the ripple effect of crime, and we work with offenders in the prisons, you know, not only obviously the victim and people all around the victim and the community, but people around the offender are also victims of what happened and are deeply, deeply impacted. And, you know, one of the things you may want to consider, and there are some programs in Madison, is that, you know, there are opportunities both for victims and I think for family members of offenders who want to talk to groups, particularly of offenders, to have them realize the depth of the harm. I can tell you that working in Green Bay with some very serious offenders, they often don't think of their family members as some of the people who have been deeply impacted, and of course they have. So I'm very sorry for your loss.
Mm. Yeah, like I said, the police were wonderful, though. Even though, you know, I mean, they had the opportunity to be critical, when they spoke with us, they were not dismissive as far as what he had done, but they were very compassionate with us. It was the news that we had trouble
sure.
with.
You know, I do want to tell you, working with a lot of family members of victims, is that there often is a fair amount of compassion for the family members of the offenders. And I don't know about your case, but I can tell you I've talked to a lot of family members that sit in courtrooms and watch the family of the victim, of the offender, on the other side of the room, and realize that they too have experienced a loss and are about to experience a loss. And so, you know, everybody's grieving that, and none of the people that I'm describing had anything to do with what happened. And so, you know, I'm glad that you called.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. It's 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Can you give me a little idea, Janine, of the scope of the restorative justice program and also the history of the program? Is it something that's very, very old?
Well, the processes and the philosophy is very old. It's old. It's, you know, you can find it in the Navajo Nation, a lot of other Indian tribes. You can find it in indigenous people in Australia and New Zealand. You can find it in African tribes. And it's interesting because in the last maybe 10, 15, 20 years, you know, the United States is really behind on restorative justice. It's in the UN documents.
Is it?
It's in the European Union documents. Canada has it throughout its system. You find it all over the world. And so if you put restorative justice and look internationally, it's all over. And we actually had an international conference dealing with issues involving Israel, Palestine, South Africa, and Northern Ireland recently. An example of that, some people may remember, Amy Beale was a Fulbright scholar who had worked in South Africa during apartheid and was murdered in a black community. And her parents were so devastated but felt so strongly about Amy's dedication towards peace and fighting apartheid that they started the Amy Beale Foundation, which continues in South Africa. Two of the murderers now work for the Amy Beale Foundation.
Oh,
and we had Amy's mother and one of the murderers come to Marquette in November and talk. We had the same thing happen, came out of Northern Ireland, where a man named Patrick McGee, who was one of the IRA terrorists who was responsible for a bombing called the Brighton bombing, when five people were killed. It was an attempt to bring down the Conservative Party of the Parliament. And the daughter of one of the people killed, they have gone out and spoken together and talked to each other. And they came to us via video conferencing because we couldn't get Patrick McGee into the country. Mm. But he was pardoned by the Good Friday Accords. Mm. And then we had a pair of people that worked together through a group called the Parents Circle, an Israeli woman whose son was killed by a Palestinian sniper and a Palestinian whose brother was killed by an Israeli soldier, working together across those lines, not with any specific agenda other than peace, but to say families are affected on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Is this something that is within the justice system? In other words, if you're in a courtroom and you're going through a trial, can the judge say, say, I want to let you know about this program, and I really urge you to participate in this.
We're finding more and more ways that it is. First of all, David Lerman is an assistant district attorney in Milwaukee, and he has run a program for a number of years on sort of some of the misdemeanors and smaller crimes, which it can really be used as, you know, as an alternative or as something that helps victims through the process. John Chisholm is dedicated to increasing that program, and we've been working with John, as David Lerman obviously is. I think he's going to increase the number. To work with juveniles, because it's one thing to work at the high end with the offenders, and it's good things for victims, but to be able to work with a juvenile, an example I always give is take a juvenile who has defaced a cemetery stone, you know, who sees it nothing other than a little prank. Take the victim of that crime, maybe the widow of somebody whose beloved husband is buried there, and if you have a widow who's willing to do that, or another widow who's willing to talk about that, do a face-to-face with that juvenile as to what that impact is. First of all, it's harder for the juvenile to do that than to go through the justice system and say, you get probation, make restitution, mm-hmm. nothing mm-hmm. happens. And I can tell you that all the statistics internationally is that crime goes down from those offenders and restitution rates go up because they've looked into the eyes of the victim and they want to pay it back.
Interesting. And you're doing some work in schools now, too, aren't you?
We did. We've been working with Milwaukee Public Schools, particularly on bullying issues and other issues. There is a big movement to try to work in, you know, to work in circles in particular in classrooms, to really have kids kind of checking in. One thing, some teachers use it really to have a circle every morning to have each student kind of talk because, you know, some kids are coming from total chaos during the night. Mm. You know, they may have been up all night. The police may have raided their homes. Mm. There may have been a shooting in the street. And then when the kids act up in school, if the teachers don't have any sense of what's going on, you get angry because the kid's being disruptive. And yet you don't know that they've actually, you know, are a trauma victim from what happened the night before. And so it's when problems arise, to give students a way to talk things through. And some of my students have done it in some of the Catholic schools. There was a Catholic school up in Green Bay, the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. It was very effective to deal with some controversial issues that those students were dealing with. And it's just a way of communication and checking in and listening to each other. We just don't listen to each other. And if we listen to each other, we learn.
Yeah. And what about if, when you're in that circle, those issues of trauma come up? What do you do with that?
Well, you know, I mean, it depends on the circumstances. And that's one of the things. These processes are really processes that need to be designed to fit the problem. But maybe it's realizing that happened. Maybe it's getting a counselor in to see mm-hmm. that student. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, it could be lots of different things. But if we don't take time to even listen and find out, then we make assumptions that are often wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think all too often we operate cities that way. I think a lot of the problems in Milwaukee are the fact that people don't understand what the problems are. So, you know, I just give this example, and this is not related to restorative justice. When we talk about jobs being a critical issue, it clearly is a critical issue. But to give a job to somebody who doesn't have a driver's license and doesn't have a car that they can't get to is a complicated problem, and they need to get through the driver's license, or they may not be able to read a map. And so it's not just one piece. By listening to what the issues are, people can understand and then work together, neighborhoods and community groups, social service agencies, to helpfully work forward. What we're hoping to do in these neighborhoods that we're going to work with is to bring together the police who are in the community policing, the prosecution, the community prosecution, the social service agencies, MPS, Department of Corrections, and the neighbors and people, small businesses, to get them in a circle and say, okay, Let's figure out what exactly is going on in the community, what the greatest needs are, and how people can work together towards resolving those instead of everybody kind of going off in their own way and not really hitting the nail on the head as to what the problem is.
So you're looking at high crime areas or
yes,
how are you determining
high crime.
This?
Yeah, well, this funding is for District 2 and 5, which are two of the very high concentration of homicides, drug activity, and particularly gang involvement. And so the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, everybody's going to be working on this grant together, and it's going to give us an opportunity. I'm excited because the police department is excited about doing this kind of work. And so to be able to get police to the table and to be able to get neighbors and have people just listen to each other and see each other as humans mm-hmm. with more in common than different mm-hmm. and then have common goals come out of it.
The police department is excited because?
Because I think that there are a number of officers and captains, and I know the captain in District 5 in particular, I've been told we're going to have a meeting soon, is really excited saying, you know, the way we're doing business isn't working. You know, we've got this revolving door through the criminal justice system, and we're not the problems are only escalating and not de-escalating. We got to find different ways to work together to be able to address the problem. Here's an example that someone gave me. If the police decide, for example, that they're going to arrest, you know, three gang members that have been engaging in behavior, before you make those arrests, to say to groups and try to figure out who are the three offenders, the young people that are going to take their place when you arrest them, and try to do some intervention with social services and other things with those individuals before you make the vacuum that creates the new problem. And, you know, and so to be able to sort of work it as a holistic way of looking at the problem, this is not soft on crime. This isn't, it's saying how can we be more effective and strategic in getting really the dangerous people off the street and locked up and get the services that we need to the others so they can become employed.
Our number is 800-486-8655-22. 72050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee, 800-486-8655, 227-2050. And we're getting an email address for Restorative Justice Initiative in a moment, too. So hold on. Evidently, somebody called in to let us know.
Okay, good.
We're speaking. Join our conversation. Janine Geske is our guest. She's director of the program. She's a distinguished professor of law at Marquette University Law School and an adjunct associate professor in the Marquette Center for Dispute Resolution Program. She served on the Wisconsin Supreme Court for a number of years, was a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge, interim Milwaukee County executive, interim dean of the Marquette Law School, and she served as chief staff attorney for the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee some time ago. We're looking at this area of restorative justice where some truly dramatic and remarkable things are happening in a healing process, and she's talking about how high crime areas in Milwaukee are going to be doing these circles and how this is being implemented really all over the world. And if you have questions, we'd love to take them from you. So 800-486-8655, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We do have an email address for the Restorative Justice Initiative, and it is Yolanda. Yolanda period Terral, Torral. And the thing is covered up here. You've got it then. Thank you.
It's at marquette.edu.
At marquette.edu. All right. And we'll give that to you again as before the hour has ended. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Janine Geske is our guest, and we have a couple lines open if you would like to join our conversation. Mimi Nostein is getting your calls and talking to you for a second, and we'll be with you on the air momentarily. Tell me about, before we go to more phone calls, Janine, if this whole philosophy is really expanding. I was interested in what you said about these huge international issues that we're dealing with. Are these restorative justice initiatives springing up all over the place?
They are. There are a couple problems. One is that it tends to be sort of an add-on program as opposed to a philosophical approach of doing business. Mm. And I feel real strongly about this. You know, we always have these little programs that start, get funded, and then they fold when the funding, as opposed to sort of integrating it into our system. It's the reason I'm trying to teach law students, and law students are coming to this, because lawyers are going to be leaders in lots of different fields, and I want them to understand the philosophical underpinnings of this. This can occur in lots of, and we need healing in lots of our institutions and other places. Mm-hmm. And you know, it doesn't focus just on crime. It focuses on harm. We worked with some African-American students on the issue of racial profiling, for example, and had them talk about that. They shifted the conversation to the discrimination that they face in the city of Milwaukee. But, you know, you work with different groups on this issue, and to be able to have lawyers who often are called in times of crisis to look at it. But there are initiatives and actions all over the country. I do want to do a caveat, and I do this every time I speak publicly. When I hear people say restoring the offender, it's a red flag to me that they're not understanding the concept. Rehabilitation of offenders is a very good thing, and I'm in favor of it. But that's not the goal of restorative justice.
Right.
It's addressing the harm. An outcome, I think, often is that there's rehabilitation. But that's not the goal. And so a lot of things are called restorative, and when it's totally focused on offenders and, you know, programming for offenders and restoring offenders to the community, and that's not restorative
justice.
That's
not what it is, yeah. I think you've made that clear. Patrick from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I'm somewhat pretty well involved in our community here in River West, and I've been a landlord for, you know, over 12 years, and I've experienced 27th Avenue, North Avenue area. I live there, and I've gotten a really good, you know, from my point of view, an awakening. What's going on in our United States, inner city especially, there's no jobs, you know, and I just always hear of programs make the Second Harvest bigger. That doesn't erase that you have, I heard recently, we have 50% unemployment in their city. You could have all the programs to tell people to be good, and, you know, it just isn't getting to the problem. You know, we basically just need more jobs. The downturn in crime through the mid-90s was people were working. Now, again, we're getting less jobs. So I can't get excited about thinking more people, educated people, are going to be running programs to tell other people that don't have jobs to be better people. I think we just have to concentrate on Bill Barrett should be in and out of town trying to lure companies into our town. But we just hear, you know, let's all get together and hold hands and pray that these young men or these people that don't have jobs are better people. I don't think anyone would be a better person if they weren't working and had all this, you know.
Mm-hmm. All right, Janine.
Yes, I don't disagree with you. This is not about telling people to be better people. It's one of the things we do is we bring together, for example, philanthropists and business people to sit in these circles. It's about understanding the problem. Clearly, jobs is a huge issue. It's not the only issue because there has to be transportation. There has to be education and training. All those things are wrapped into employment. And this is just a process for people to get together to understand what the harm is and what the problems are, and then to create solutions. And certainly getting more jobs is a large part of the problem.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Bruce next. Hi, Bruce, you're on the air.
Well, your speaker is right on target. The issue has always been lack of communication. We live in a very size America. People just push their own agenda, as we've seen in the last few years. The only place I've ever seen the talking stick used, other than in the Indian cultures, in white culture, is in the Indian Guide program that used to be sponsored by the Y. This was a group for fathers and sons and fathers and daughters, and we had the talking stick. It was a way to pass around so everybody had a chance to talk. You listened, you respected each other, you heard each other. And that's the basis of this kind of restorative justice, is this kind of communication that's honest and genuine. And I think this is an excellent program. I'm delighted to hear this. And I actually have the walking stick that we used when my son was 6 years old, which is something I keep because, to me, it's a symbol of the ability of people to actually talk to one another.
That's great.
I'm very, very proud to hear that this is going on and being applied in situations where it's really needed, where you need to have wealthy industrialists talk to the black guys that don't have... realize they need transportation, they need job training, and all this stuff.
You think about it, it's limitless the number of people you could bring together, and good could come from it, right?
Yes, that's right. Well, and one of the other thoughts, and first of all, I want to really appreciate the call from the caller, because you can see it was significant in his life, and I'm happy to hear that it was used in that context. I think among family, I've heard people do it at funerals, actually, pass around and tell stories. But I think, you know, it is limitless in the sense that you could bring people, for example, from the suburbs who are afraid, to let them really meet people in this community. People in all parts of this community are good. There are people who live in fear, but there are good people, really saints working in our central city trying to do good work. And if only people could reduce their fear level by getting to know each other as humans and see the work, they could support each other instead of all of us locking our doors and being afraid.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call. Let's go next to Silas from Chicago. Hi, Silas.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to concur with your guest about restorative justice. I come from Africa, from a tribe which uses that kind of justice system. What happens is that the community sets up a fine for almost, more or less, almost every crime committed by within the community. And what happens is the offender and the and the victim's family do meet at such kind of a sitting, whereby the offender is made to relieve the crime he committed, and most times they realize that the reasons behind they are committing that crime were really not justified for the actions, and this makes them feel more remorseful and really sorry about the whole thing. And most of the time, they feel that they should kind of come out and try to, make good of, become better people within the community. Likewise, the victim's family gets to a position whereby they accept the person and try to understand the reasons why he committed such a crime against their family.
Mm-hmm.
And this really does help them restore their peace. And I found it working very well within the community.
Hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Silas, very much.
And I appreciate the call, because that is a perfect explanation of you know, the process and what's supposed to come from it. So I really appreciate the call.
Yeah. Let's look at some of the horrendous crimes that we've had recently. I'm thinking of, you know, gang rapes of 12-year-old girls and 11-year-old girls. It has been discussed, Janine, that there are a lot of people, an increasing number of people, who have sort of lost their moral compass, who don't know right from wrong. And I want you to talk about that, if you're seeing increasing numbers of that, and if you can have any of these people be a part of a restorative justice program, does it do any good, or are we just having people who are just, forgive me for being simplistic, bad people?
Well, in working with offenders and offenders who have committed these kinds of crimes, let me tell you who a lot of these offenders are. They are the children we've read about in the newspaper that have been sexually and physically abused as babies and small kids.
Mm.
And so their moral compass has been formed by the fact that they've been traumatized and victimized and often not raised in a loving community. So there is no empathy. It is pure survival.
Mm.
And as offenders talk, and we put them through these processes at the prison with the warden's blessing, what happens is they'll talk about, they see people as cardboard cutouts. They don't see them as humans. I mean, they aren't reacting. And to have to sort of confront that really does change. I'm not advocating people who have committed those kinds of crimes ought to get out of prison. You know, not for a moment. But I can tell you that when we do a three-day intensive program at Green Bay Prison, we've been doing it for 9-10 years with victims of crimes of severe violence, not their crime, and about 40 inmates. At the end of those 3 days, these offenders are often weeping. They're admitting crimes that they don't have to admit to, and they are talking about, out of all the programming they've ever had to confront and listen to victims and hear the impact that they've had, you know, really hits them in their hearts and changes their behavior in prison. That's one of the reasons the wardens like it, is that the offender's, you know, behavior gets better. But I think we need to do that in earlier age to prevent having those kinds of crimes happen.
Yeah, right. Thanks for the call. Polly is next from Barron County. Hi, Polly.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, Janine.
Hi, Polly.
You know each other?
Yeah. A restorative justice leader.
I run restorative justice in Barron County, and we just had our board meeting today. You know, we have hundreds of volunteers in Barron County that participate in all 9 of our programs with 7 paid staff, and we have from law enforcement, obviously our judge, as well as our judges, as well as the school districts in our county participating in circles. And we looked at our crime statistics today, and just to make it quickly short, we looked at our, you know, we're not a big crime area, but in the year before we started restorative justice here, which was 98, we adjudicated 98 kids, which means we charged them with criminal offenses. And in 2006, last year, our numbers just came in, and we charged 20.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, I have to say, Barron County is really an example of what particularly a small county can do with integrating it at all levels. And they have just done a superb job. Polly and Judge Bruner and other people in that county have come together, and they've engaged everyone, and it really is a model on how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your call. Stigma from Madison, hello.
Hello?
Yes, go right ahead.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you know, I'm a member of the Parents for Murdered Children group, and we are a very diverse group. Some are for, others are against the death penalty. And I lost my parents years ago through a drunk driver, and it took 5 years until we could cry. But, I, you know, Sharon Tate's mother, remember the Manson murder murders? She worked with offenders in prison and, you know, rapists, murderers. And they said for the first time in their life they realized what they had done, and some of them cried. And they had never been in touch with their feelings before. It was an amazing experience. I think we need to do more of that.
Mm-hmm. And I appreciate the call. I've certainly worked with a number of members of your group. I do want to say this is not for everybody. And you know, no one is ever critical of a victim or a family member of a victim who does not want to engage in these kinds of processes. Everybody's got to walk their own journey. But for those who choose to do it, they do find it very healing.
20 seconds. A lot of money in that Supreme Court race in the state. A bit too much.
Yeah, it was a very disturbing race, and I can only hope that we all step back before the next race next year and say we don't want this in Wisconsin and find a way to collectively look at this issue, take, you know, do public financing and have candidates that will not tolerate that these kinds of ads.
So you're looking for, if people wanted to help out in some way, they should give this, did we ever get the right number, 288?
7090 and ask for restorative justice. I know that will work. Yeah, we are going to be gathering names of volunteers and hopefully ultimately training people in processes. And even if you can't do it, we want to come into the central city to be able to use these processes within your own communities and groups. It can promote healing and better listening and caring about each other.
Yeah. Here's to you. You're one incredible person. Thanks for being with us, Jeanine.
Thanks, Kevin.
Jeanine Geske, she is the Distinguished Professor of Law at Marquette, and she's the Director of the Restorative Justice Initiative at Marquette University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to Mimi Notstein for on-air production here in our studios. This show, in case you want to tell somebody about it, will repeat at 10 o'clock tonight. Or if you'd like a copy of it, call the radio store. The phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. A major report being released on Friday on the effect that global warming has already had on the world. We'll be looking at that, and we'll talk about the power of President Lincoln's words. This is the Ideas Network.